Welcome, everyone, including Terry. It's great to have you here. Chapter 5 is all about operating systems, but first, it's welcome to another edition of ITE Class 1, Chapter 5. I almost forgot that signature bit. Another edition of. And this is going to be a lecture of two halves. The first hour will be spent with me, and the second hour will be from Elise Lonsdale, who is, of course, my supervisor and mentor and friend and kicker up the ass and all kind of sort of, my generally pushes me along. And I'm handing the second hour of this lecture over to Elise so she can tell you all about how to install the damn things once we have told you all about how they work and what they are and all that palaver. And then we'll have a little bit of time at the end just to discuss worksheets and things, because here is where the amount of work ramps up to a briefly insane level. And I'm saying briefly because it gets back to pretty much normal again after chapter 5. Yeah, and even in chapter 8, where there's a whole lot of new concepts, the worksheet workload is not onerous. So once you get over chapter 5's hump, things go back to reasonable again until you get into the advanced part of the course, and then things ramp up a little bit again. So welcome everyone to the operating systems. Okay. An operating system controls almost all functions on a computer. And in this chapter, you will learn about the components, functions, and terminology related to the Windows 2000, how very antiquated, Windows XP, not quite so antiquated, Windows Vista, let's not go there, and Windows 7 operating systems. Okay, the purpose of an operating system. Okay, now all computers rely on them for interaction between users and applications and hardware, and we'll talk more about this as we go. The OS boots the computer and manages the file system, and almost all modern operating systems can support more than one user, task, or CPU. Now, there are four things an OS does. The first of them is control access to hardware, and that's to the motherboard, adapter cards, and drives, etc. And it does this via device drivers. Now, device drivers are little applets written by the hardware manufacturer, and they're supplied with the hardware so that when you get a modern motherboard, not so much in older ones, but in modern motherboards and with video cards, things like that, you will get little pieces of software with them called device drivers. And the OS assigns these resources to the correct places via plug and play. Plug and play is supposed to work in theory like this, and I say in theory because we'll be exploring more about this, particularly in Chapter 7, where things don't actually quite work out as they say here. But it says when a new device is
That's why we
plugged
call it
in.
plug and pray.
Yeah, exactly. Plug and play is more like it. When a device is plugged in, the OS is supposed to detect the and install the right driver. It does this, but it usually does it with a generic driver, which is not always the most suitable one to use. The best drivers to use with any hardware are those supplied by the manufacturer. And it's a good idea, and I'll be reiterating this again in later chapters, that before you plug and play, that you install the proper drivers onto the system. Because if you don't do that, if you try to let Windows install the generic driver first and then try to put the manufacturer driver on top, it's a goodbye system. You may even need a rebuild. So don't be doing that. Always follow the manufacturer's instructions when you're installing a driver. Really, really important. Anyway, what happens is the registry gets updated, and the registry is a database with everything in the computer. And we'll talk more about registries next week. You don't have to know too much about those at the moment. So the first thing an OS does is manage and control the access to the hardware via device drivers. Are we clear so far?
Crystal.
Absolutely.
Phantasmagonical. Okay. The second thing an OS does is manage the files and folders. Now, this is about structure on the hard disk drive, and that allows the data to be stored. Now, a file is a block of related data that is given a single name and treated as a single unit. That's important. A file is a block of data that is given a single name and treated as a single unit. Program and data files are grouped together in a directory or a folder. And those of us who've been around long enough for DOS will remember that these are directories, and they are in Linux, but in Windows, directories are called folders, and the other folders or directories inside of those are called subdirectories. And they're organized hopefully for easy retrieval and use, although that is also arguable. Okay. So the second thing is it provides a file structure. Right. The third thing an OS does is provide a user interface. And that's about the way a user interacts with the software and hardware on the computer. There are two types of user interface. Can anyone tell me what they are?
One's GUI, isn't it? Graphical user interface.
Yeah, you're right, Terry. One is the GUI, and the other
command
one is the
line
CL.
Interface.
Yeah,
command line
John.
Interface.
Yes, you've got it. Okay. Now, these are very different. With a command line interface, CLI, you type commands at a prompt. You need to know a fair amount how the machine and the OS works to do this. You need much more knowledge. But as a trade-off, the CLI is actually a lot less resource hungry. So you need a lot more knowledge, but you'll use a lot fewer of the computer's resources. In contrast, a graphical user interface, or GUI, means that you interact with menus and icons using a keyboard or a mouse. Yes, it's more intuitive because it's much more easy to understand, but it's much more resource hungry because of all the pretty pictures and things that seem to be needed to go along with it. So all Windows OSs have both a GUI and a CLI. Now the fourth thing that an OS does is manage applications. Applications are loaded and located and loaded into the RAM, which is random access memory, of course. And that's partly why more RAM is usually better. But it also depends on how much RAM the OS can use at one time. And we'll talk more about that a little bit later. Now, the OS will do its best to make sure each application has enough resources, of course, always providing that there are enough resources on the computer for that to happen. Now, there are ways that programs interact with each other, and the common one that we like to think of is an application programming interface, or API, and you'll see this term popping up from time to time. You've probably seen it pop up on the net, and what this is a set of guidelines that are used by programmers to ensure that the application they're developing is compatible with an operating system. There are two examples of APIs that they mention here. One is Open Graphics Library, which is a cross-platform standard specifically for multimedia graphics. And the one that you will be more familiar with and you'll get to play around with is good old DirectX. There's actually a worksheet where you get to mess around with DirectX. It's really quite cool. And DirectX is a collection of APIs related to multimedia tasks for Microsoft Windows. And the latest version of DirectX is 9.0c. You can check your version of DirectX by going into opening a command prompt. Can someone tell me how to do that?
Alt
Kim,
R.
How do you...
No, it Kim. Windows R for run.
You wanted to know about the command to get... It's Windows R, if I understood you.
Yes, Terry said Windows R for run. And then what do you do after run, people?
Oh, CMD.
And
commanders.
And press
oh, I said
enter.
CMD. I'm not sure if it got through. Oh, press enter.
Okay, so if you opened a command prompt by hitting Windows R and then typing CMD and pressing enter, and then typing the command DXDIAG and pressing enter, you'd get into the workings of DirectX and you'd be able to play around with how the computer draws figures, how it presents sound, all that good stuff. So it's 5.4.8 from memory, the worksheet where you get to play around with this and all kinds of other resources in your machine, and it's actually quite fun. Well, I thought it was anyway. I was like a big kid again. Anyhow, in summary, the four things that an OS does is it controls hardware access, manages files, provides a user interface, or two of them, and manages applications. Are we all clear as mud so far?
Yep.
Wonderful. Okay. Section 5.1.2, if you're following in your notes, is explain operating system concepts. Now that we know what these things do, We have to know some terminology. There's always lots of terminology in this course, and this is no exception. Okay, multi-user. Now, these things can be a bit confusing, so it's good to be aware of the differences in this terminology set. And the first one is the term multi-user. And that's reasonably self-explanatory. It's when two or more users can work with programs and share peripheral devices like printers at the same time. So that's multi-user. Multitasking, on the other hand, is when the computer is capable of operating multiple applications at the same time. So one's about multiple users and one's about multiple applications. The third term in this list is multiprocessing. And that's when the computer can have two or more central processing units that programs share. Now, these days, it's done by building multiple processors onto a single chip. Of course, you can have more than one physical CPU on some motherboards. We'll actually take that. That's when they really wanted a kick-ass computer a few years ago before they started all these lovely multi-core things. And the last term is multi-threading. And that's when a program can be broken into smaller parts so it can be loaded as needed by the operating system. And even single core processors like my old machine here can be multi-threading. And that allows individual programs to be multitasked. So almost all modern OSs are multi-user and multitasking, and they support multi-processing and multi-threading. So it's really important to be aware of the differences in those terms. Okay, someone's just disappeared.
Elise.
Ooh, okay. He is hoping. Okay, modes of operation is the next. There are four different modes of operation.
Kylie, Elise got disconnected, so she's coming back up.
Yeah, okay, no problem. Just was worried about somebody missing out, but we are recording. That's not a problem at all. Okay, modes of operation. And the mode of operation is all about the capability of the computer processor and the OS environment. The mode of operation determines how the CPU manages applications and memory allocation. And there are four common modes. They are real mode, protected mode, virtual real mode, and compatibility mode. Okay, who besides me remembers the days of DOS?
Oh boy, I'm afraid so.
Weren't them good days when you thought a 640 meg hard drive was just the cat's whiskers?
Oh, yeah, fantastic.
Welcome back, Elise. Yep, good.
Thanks. Now, you are recording, hun, right?
Yes, I'm recording. We're talking about modes of operation here, and we're just reminiscing about DOS.
Right. Ah, yes, good
okay.
Old DOS, don't we love it?
And DOS operates in something called real mode. It can only execute one program at a time, and it can only address 1 meg of system memory. Okay, all modern processors have real mode available, but it's only used by these older applications and by 16-bit operating systems like good old Windows 3X. That was before me. I actually went from DOS to Windows XP. What a big leap that was. Anyway, that's real mode. It can only address 1 meg of RAM. Hello there.
Is this the redundant systems up?
Okay, good. Okay, that's real mode. It can only address 1 meg of memory, system memory, and only execute one program at a time. The next mode is protected mode, and that's what you'll see in most OSs now. Protected mode has access to all of the memory in the computer, including the virtual memory. Now, virtual memory is actually hard drive space that emulates memory. So if your computer needs more memory that's available in RAM, it will commandeer some hard drive space in order to perform its functions, and that's called virtual memory. And you can play around with how much of hard drive space you use in performance, but that's not. And we don't have to look at it in this chapter. We don't actually get to really look at virtual memory until chapter 12 from memory. Now, protected mode can manage multiple programs simultaneously, and protected mode provides 32-bit access to memory, drivers, and transfers between input and output I/O devices. protected mode is used by 32-bit operating systems such as Windows 2000 or Windows XP. So at the moment, my 32-bit system here is operating in protected mode. Now, protected mode applications are protected from using the memory reserved for other applications that are currently running. That's really important. So in protected mode, it will ring-fence the resources it needs for the various applications, which is an important difference to real mode, one of the many differences. Okay, the third mode, so we have real mode and protected mode. The third mode is virtual real mode. Now, it's a bit like a compatibility mode, really, because a CPU that operates in virtual real mode allows a real mode application to run within a protected mode operating system. And I'd say, wouldn't you, Terry, that the Z5 interpreter for games would be that kind of application?
I guess it would. I don't know. The FROTS one you're talking about.
Yes, because it allows you to run DOS games in a Windows environment. Yeah, I think that's actually quite a good example of virtual real mode. So it's really a sort of compatibility mode. Now, there's a list of still used DOS commands in Figure 2 of this section. So have a look at that, because you can use those on the command line when you're operating that user interface. Now, we're going to spend a little bit of time on this next mode, because it's compatibility mode. And compatibility mode creates the environment of an earlier operating system for applications that are not compatible with the current operating system. And those of you with Windows Vista and 7, which I think is most of you, have XP mode, which is theoretically lets you run XP apps on your more modern box, as if you're running XP. That's what compatibility mode does. Now,
can I chip in for a second?
Yeah, sure.
You might be going to answer it with what you were about to say, but I was looking on the internet at a product that I wanted to buy, and it said it operated in XP and Vista, but you're telling me that if I can change my computer over to this compatibility mode, I might still be able to run that program?
Theoretically. How well it works in actual practice, I have no idea. Elise, you might have something to say about that perhaps, but there are ways to do it, but how well it works in practice, I don't know. Not here? Okay. There are several ways that you can do this. You've got Windows 7, Kate?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll cover Vista first, because you need to know about Vista and 7 for exams. And by the way, I'm not saying test alerts throughout this, but there are two exams that are related to this chapter. There's a whole heap of Windows 7 stuff that you'll start to learn here, and there's a separate Windows 7 exam to be set along with the Chapter 5. Now, you don't have to sit the Windows 7 now, but a lot of the stuff that's in the Windows 7 exam are in this chapter, so pay a lot of attention to the Windows 7 content, because you will need it for later on for sitting that exam. Okay, it says here, to use XP mode in Vista, locate the program and choose properties from the .exe file. So you need to actually load the installer of the program. And there's a compatibility tab in there, which you can choose the OS the app was made for, limit the colors and themes, etc. And another way you can do compatibility in Vista is to override the user account control UAC, which is a source of annoyance for so many, I believe, because it nags you and nags you and nags you whenever you try to breathe, so much as breathe or do anything on your machine. Now, this allows an application to be run even if the user does not have the required administrative privileges. And sometimes I've noticed that when you go to upgrade things like Twitter, the UAC will come up even if you've turned it off to say that, do you want to run this, as an administrator? And you have to answer yes to get access to it. So that's another way of running
sure
a compatibility mode. Exactly.
No, only to keep alive.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the UACs in Windows 7 were tidied up quite a good deal nicer than what they were in Vista, because they just, it was a common complaint by users is that the UAC was just getting in the way.
I turned mine off.
You got a lot more control over it with 7, but yeah, I turned mine off too. I don't want to know about it.
Yeah, in Vista you can only have it fully turned on or fully turned off, but in Windows 7 you've got a whole lot more flexibility. The default in Windows 7 is notify me only when programs try to make changes to my computer. And you get there, you can alter the state that your UAC is in Windows 7 by going to the Control Panel and User Accounts and Family Safety, and then User Accounts and Change User Account Control Settings. And you can look at the diagram, figure 3 in this section for more information about what other
I'll
controls there
just
are
type
for
in
the
user access
UAC.
control on the search bar. That'll get you there about 10 times quicker.
Yes, it will. We have there are always quicker ways to get places than a lot of these instructions say. And when we get time at the end to talk a little bit about worksheets, we'll talk about that because some of the instructions can be a little bit confusing and you don't actually have to follow them as per se to actually get where you want to go. It doesn't matter how you navigate there, as long as you get there. And there's a little note here that there's the control panel in Windows 7 has three views: category, large icons, and small icons. And this course unfortunately uses the category view, which is totally unworkable for most of us who use screen readers. If you use a screen reader in Windows 7, you'll want to scratch around and change your view to small icons for screen reader workability. So that's just a little note in there. Unfortunately, Cisco will be using the category view as the main option, so just be
Are we
aware of
talking about
that.
the control panel?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, just put in compatibility. Category, just put it in small or list view. That category view is hopeless.
Okay,
Mine's
before I
on
go
list view. Before I
List two
go
is mine.
any further with a little feature in Windows 7 that we've got here, are there any questions so far about the four modes of operation that we've been talking about? Okay, awesome, good stuff. Now, there's a feature in Windows 7 that you can run if you strike a problem running an older app, and it's called the Compatibility Troubleshooter. And there are a long set of instructions in your notes. I'll go through them quickly because I don't know if anyone has ever actually tried using it, how well it works. But it says, click Start, Control Panel. In the search box, type Troubleshooter and click Troubleshooting in the list displayed. I don't know why you have to go into Control Panel first before you do that, but never mind. Three, under Programs, click Run Programs Made for Previous Versions of Windows and click Next. So if here from up to this point at least, you're following a bouncing ball pretty much. It's pretty much a wizard sort of operation. Windows will search for the compatibility issues and a list of programs will be brought up for you to look at. You choose the program you're having problems with and click Next. If the program's not listed, you can select Not Listed and then Next. And you can browse to locate the program and then click Open and Next. So this is a fairly standard way that Windows operates. If you don't have something there, you can always browse for it. So there's nothing very horrifyingly new or difficult about this. It's a standard way that Windows works. You can choose to try recommended settings, run the program using settings that Windows 7 has determined to be the most compatible, or you can choose Troubleshoot program, which lets you select troubleshooting steps based on the problems that you've noticed. So you have various ways that you can approach this. Then you start the program to see if the problem is solved. You click Next. If it's solved and you want to apply the changes you've made, then you click Next to apply the settings permanently, or repeat the process to choose different settings until you've achieved compatibility. And it goes through all that and gives you a much quicker way to get to the compatibility troubleshooter in the first place. Just run the program by right-clicking the program's shortcut, the program you're having trouble with, or icon, and then choose Troubleshoot Compatibility, which is much more sensible and much quicker, wouldn't you say?
Sounds it to me. Now, I'm also wondering, I've got a program that claims that it is Windows 7 compatible and it is actually running okay on my computer, but it won't run on my daughter's computer. So would I be able to use that method to try on my daughter's computer and see if I can fix it up that way?
Why not? Worth a try. It'd be good to see how you get on, actually.
Yeah, I'm having a login issue with a service here, and I can log in on my computer, but I can't log in on hers. So I'm not sure whether it's their fault or mine.
Well, the troubleshooter might be helpful in telling you that. How helpful, given it's a Windows app, I don't know, but worth a try.
I might try that.
I've no idea how accessible it is either. These new things, you know, it's never known until you try them, I suppose. But yeah, so that's our real modes: compatibility mode, virtual real mode, protected mode, and real mode. Okay, the next thing we have to talk about is the difference between 34 and 64-bit. Now, we're hearing more and more about 64-bit OSs as people go onto Windows 7, because the recommendation seems to be around the place that 64-bit is the only Windows 7 flavour worth having. But in any case, a 64-bit is different from a 32-bit OS in three main ways. First is greater memory addressing. Now, remember earlier I said that it was a good idea to have lots of RAM because of better performance, and partly that was due to the how much the operating system can use at one time. This is what memory addressing is all about. So 32-bit operating systems, like my one here, Windows XP, can only address up to 4 gigabytes of RAM. Now, I have an XP system on my laptop that has 4 gigs. There's no point in having any more, even if my motherboard could support it, because the OS wouldn't be able to see it or use it anyway. However, a 64-bit system, such as Elise has, can use more than 128 gigabytes of RAM. That's pretty amazing. So it's able to use far more memory at one time. So the first difference is greater memory addressing. The second one here is a little bit more nebulous, and Elise, you might be able to flesh this out a bit. It says enhanced memory management. 64-bit systems just perform better. Their applications perform better over 32-bit. That doesn't really say anything more than that.
Yeah, it can address more. It can address more memory, as you said, and it can. Basically everything runs a lot faster because it's addressing more of the memory at any one time. It's addressing more of the processor at any one time, 64-bit rather than 32-bit. So everything's happening. There's more at any given time. That's about the best I could really say at the moment.
The third major difference between the two is additional security. 64-bit has additional security to 32-bit systems. And the two ways it does that are kernel patch protection, and that disallows third-party drivers from modifying the kernel. I'm not quite sure exactly how that works, but it means that you can't have drivers make change to the basic part of the operating system. Mandatory driver signing, though, is what it says. Yep.
Is that why we can't run, like if you're using JAWS 11 or higher, there's that braille display drivers. JAWS want you to get those stupid signed braille display drivers, and I think you can't run them if you've got a 64-bit system, can you?
Not unless they've passed Microsoft's signing. No, you can't, because 64-bit needs signed drivers.
So that's why, because you can run them on a 32-bit, I think. And is that why, because they're trying to operate that patch protection thingy there, is that why you wouldn't be able to do it, operate them on a 64-bit system?
Yeah, that would be exactly why, because the other security feature that 64-bit systems use is mandatory driver signing. So you can't use drivers that haven't been signed by Microsoft, which is a pain in the bum, because a lot of drivers that haven't been signed by Microsoft actually work quite well in 32-bit systems. So that's a bit of a restriction there. The drivers have to pass Microsoft's quality control tests. So are we all clear on the differences between 32 and 64-bit systems?
Yep, that's no trouble.
Cool. Okay, let's get even more geeky for a bit and talk about processor architecture. What fun. Now, there are two common architectures used by CPUs to process data. And you will have seen these on some some application labels, for instance, the version of Microsoft's own vulnerability analysis tool or their antivirus anti-spyware tools are assigned with either x86 for 32-bit or x64 for 64-bit. I'm not quite sure why 86 for 32, but maybe Elise can tell me.
I can, because all of the 32-bit processors were originally based on the Intel x86 being 286, 386, and 486 processors, and then we went into the Pentiums, and it's just something that stuck. I think the 64 bit's a bit different, so that's why we just say 64. So you might have seen the term around 32, something rather 32, and it was often used to distinguish a program from something rather 16, which would have been for its Windows 95, Windows 3.11 counterpart. So you'd have to get the 16-bit version for Windows 3.1 and this 32-bit version for Windows 95 and above, etc., etc. This is one step further from that.
Okay,
the same thing occurs in Linux, too. If we see the Linux x86 breeds, that usually means for the 32-bit processors, and the x64-bit ones mean for the 64-bit, so that it's sort of the standard that's across all the operating systems.
Okay, and I was just curious about why it's 86 and not 32. Well, it answers that. Anyway, it uses the CISC processor architecture, and who can remember from Chapter 1 what the CISC architecture is?
Yeah, its partner is RISC, but I've forgotten their name.
Common instruction set something.
Almost, Mario.
It's the complex instruction set. Complex, actually, yeah. And that's it performs very rapidly. Of course, it needs to accommodate the higher end calculations. x86 processors use fewer registers than x64 processors do, and x64 architecture is backward compatible with x86 and adds additional registers specifically for instructions that use a 64-bit address space. Remember, we can address more resources if we've got a 64-bit system. The additional registers of the x64 architecture allow the computer to process much more complex instructions at a much higher rate, obviously. Okay, now the three diagrams at the end of the section, 5.1x, the first one is about memory types and their logical memory allocations. I found that incredibly confusing. Just read through it and make sure you're aware of it. Diagram 2, however, is the common DOS commands that I mentioned before, and you might want to have this handy when you're working worksheet 5.4.8, because you get to mess around with the command line and your MS Info, and DirectX, all kinds of places. It's really quite cool. So have a look at the diagrams at the end of section 5.1. Have I confused anybody horribly yet?
Nope.
Damn! I am so losing my touch. Never mind, let's have a try on the next section, 5.2. Describe and compare operating systems to include purpose, limitations, and compatibilities. That sounds incredibly frighteningly verbose and horrible, but it's not really. It's all about choosing the right operating system for the right environment. Okay, so because technicians are actually asked to do this, customers say, okay, I'm having a new system here. What sort of operating system do I need? You go out and you purchase it, you test it for me, and you get it up and running. So as a tech, you might be having to be involved in all those things. And of course, what you select depends on the customer's needs for the computer. There are two distinct types of OS, and they're desktop operating systems and network operating systems, or NOS. A desktop OS is intended for use in a small office, home office, or Soho, with a limited number of users. A network OS is designed for a corporate environment serving multiple users with a wide range of needs, obviously. Okay, let's look at desktop OS 5.2.1. A desktop OS has the following characteristics. It supports a single user, runs single user applications, that is applications are designed, that those designed for only having one user at a time, shares files and folders on a small network with limited security, and there are three categories of OS: Microsoft Windows, Apple Mac, and Unix Linux, and we'll talk a little bit about those. Now, in your notes it goes through a whole list of what each Windows category is about, and there's a general rule of thumb, and this doesn't include XP. XP Professional is used on most computers which connect to a server or a network. And that includes some home computers. This machine, for instance, is running XP Professional. XP Home is used on home computers, and it's got very limited security in comparison to Windows XP. And XP also has Media Center and Tablet PC Edition, which are pretty self-explanatory. This is all explained in your notes. And of course, 64-bit. It has a 64-bit flavour. I don't know many people who actually used XP in 64-bit. Because of the memory addressing, it really wasn't worth it, I wouldn't have thought. It also mentions Windows 2000, which no one uses. Programs
supported.
No, there probably wasn't, actually. And I don't blame them, because, I mean, why would you? If you can only use 4 gig of memory, 64-bit's going to be a little bit superfluous. Okay. It talks about Windows Vista and Windows 7, and there's a general rule of thumb to remember here when you go through this list of the different flavours of Windows and what they do. Your Basic Edition, which is equivalent in Basic for Vista and Starter for Windows 7, is basically a cut-down version to make networking easy. Your Home Premium or Premium Editions are about sharing files and media, that kind of thing. Your professional versions are designed for business, and your ultimate to combine the ease of both the home premium and the business. And in Windows 7, there are some neat extra features that you'll get in ultimate that you don't get in any other system. Just let me read ahead, hang on. So read right through all those, just so that you get an idea of what flavour of Windows does what, because it helps you choose which one is going to be suitable for you and which one's going to be suitable for a customer. For instance, there's a feature called BitLocker. We don't actually talk about what that is too much. That is only available in the ultimate of Windows 7 and not in any other flavour of the operating system. So that's all the various flavours of Windows. They seem to be getting more and more and more all the time. Are we all clear so far?
All clear.
Fantastic. Okay, good old Apple Mac. And Apple is proprietary. It's hard to say that when you've been yakking all this time and you're getting a bit dry. And it uses an operating system called Mac OS. Mac OS is designed to be a user-friendly GUI. And a GUI is?
Graphical user interface.
Hey, excellent. And it is a very user-friendly. That's actually what people seem to like most about the Mac. Macs are actually really good for if you've got a customer, for instance, who isn't particularly tech-savvy and wants everything just to work and not know how it works, a Mac's actually good for that, because it just does what it says it will do, and the user doesn't have to worry too much about it or learn all that much if they don't want to. So, yeah, a Mac is a very user-friendly GUI from that viewpoint. And the current version of the Mac is called Snow Leopard, and it's based on a customized version of Unix, which we'll talk about next. I think there's a version called Lion coming up, which is the next one. I'm not quite sure what enhancements it has over Snow Leopard, but it'll be interesting to see what enhancement in the built-in VoiceOver screen reader has, because each subsequent Mac version has brought out enhancements for its VoiceOver screen reader along with enhancements for the general OS. But Snow Leopard actually does support Microsoft Exchange, which is a form of email and messaging, which is very handy for businesses. Okay, Unix Linux. And I know that Elise is a Linux fan, and there are a lot of Linux fans in Cavi. And Linux was introduced in the late 1960s, and it's one of the oldest OSs. There are heaps of different versions of Unix, but one of the most recent is the extremely popular Linux, and that was invented by Linus Torvalds, a Swedish guy, I believe. I was very emphatically Finnish, informed that he was Swedish. Finnish. Yeah, okay.
Was he?
In 91, yeah. And is designed as an open source OS. Now, the cool thing about open source is that you can grab the source code and change it as you wish, either for a small fee or for no fee at all. So that's kind of neat if you've got that skill. And they do note here that all commands are based on the Windows XP paths unless otherwise specified. But I will always mention whether it's XP, Vista or Windows 7 when I come to talking about paths for doing different things later on. Okay, so are we all clear about that a desktop operating system is about single users and small tasks, I suppose, basically, is the best way to put it in a nutshell. Okay.
All clear.
Cool. Network operating systems, on the other hand, are for supporting multiple users. They run multi-user applications, and they're robust and redundant. Can anyone tell me what robust and redundant means?
That means that they can do more things at once, and they can multi-users can use the same thing at the same time?
No, because that's actually one of the characteristics of the NOS anyhow. But robust and redundant means that they have multiple systems and they have multiple fail-safes. So that if something breaks down, there's much more chance that they'll stay up and running. Because they're being used in a large corporate environment, those fail-safes are needed. Otherwise, if the thing crashes, you're in trouble. And the business may suffer. There may be all kinds of consequences to an NOS crashing that don't exist for a desktop application or a desktop system. So you need those fail-safes. Redundancy, of course, in computer terms, is what, people?
Safety.
Yeah, but what does it involve? What does redundancy involve? Think of what RAID is, and then you'll get it.
It's backing up and having extra copies of things so that your data is always safe.
Yeah, basically about spare stuff, whether it's hardware or software capability. That's extra redundancy.
Stuff. I broke my headset and have another one. That was horrible.
There you go.
Well, it's lucky you had redundancy built into your plan there, and that's one thing we all learn as computer techs is to have redundancy. And especially as blind people, it's kind of important because our computer is our eyes and ears on the world, and especially on the information world. And so if we don't have, a way to keep on being on the air when something goes wrong, we're screwed.
Pretty much, after my lightning strike last year, I just kept going along on the EEE PC until this machine was redone and had a new motherboard put in it and OS installed, etc., etc. So it's always good to have some redundancy. That's why I have that extra system here recording. I should have had it on when this system went down before. There you go, that's what happens. Fortunately, Kylie's been my redundant recording system today, and you'll send me over the file to edit later, won't you?
I might, if you're nice to me. Of course I will.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's up to you if you want your lecture to go up. Well, I've actually got the redundant system up and running now anyway, which I should have had doing. Just when you think it's safe not to, something will happen. So there you go.
Good old Murphy. It's that week too. It's St. Patrick's Day coming up, but he's not on anyone's Christmas card list as far as I know.
There you go.
Anyhow, some common network operating systems are Windows 2000 Server, which I don't know if anyone uses anymore, Windows Server 2003, and Windows Server 2008. Windows Server operating systems use a central database called Active Directory to manage network resources. Okay, now good old Novell NetWare, when I was working at Radio NZ, this was still around, even though it's really, really old. It's a really early network OS by a company called Novell, and we were still using GroupWise. I hated it compared to... I think if I could almost have put up with Outlook rather than silly old GroupWise. But Novell NetWare is still clinging on in some places. Linux, of course, is one that a lot of people use, and there are all kinds of flavours of network operating system. Red Hat, which is now called Fedora, I believe, Caldera, SUSE, Debian, Ubuntu, and Slackware. Now, I know Elise uses Fedora, and Kerry over at Perth uses Ubuntu. So it really does depend on what you like. They have different ways of operating. I think the Vinux, which is the screen reader friendly version, which has a screen reader built into it, also uses Ubuntu, if I remember correctly.
It's basically a flavour of Ubuntu, I think. Yeah, it is.
And of course, there's good old Unix, which is still used in a lot of corporations. A lot of places use proprietary versions of the old Unix systems itself. And there's a worksheet about upgrading hardware and determining that kind of thing. There's actually a lot of worksheets in this, but we'll talk about that at the end of lecture. How are we going for time? Oh, yeah, we're fine. 10 minutes to go before I hand you over. And that should be enough to cover section 5.3, determine operating system based on customer needs. Now, are we all clear so far on the types of network and desktop OSs that are around? Cool. All right.
Now that I've finished eating lunch, yes.
Oh, good. Excellent. I'm glad that's made a big difference. Right. Selecting the right OS for your customer. Basically, of course, common sense says to meet the requirements of your customer, you need to understand how the customer wants to use the computer. No shit. Okay. The operating system that you recommend...
Don't Kylie.
Yeah, well, it's kind of obvious, isn't it, really? I mean, the operating system should be compatible with any applications that will be used and should support all hardware that is installed in the computer. Now, that hardware thing is really important. Of course it should be compatible with applications used. I mean, folks, I'm not going to spend a huge amount of time on this because this is so mostly common sense. It really is. I mean, I know you know this, so I'm not going to insult you by going through this with a fine-tooth comb. Okay, obviously if the computer is going to be attached to a network, it needs an OS that should be compatible with other operating systems that are on the network. Now, you need to choose applications that are going to be compatible with this. And here are a few guidelines. I'll just run through those really quite quickly. Firstly, does the computer have off-the-shelf applications or customized applications? If the customer will be using a customized app, the programmer of that application will hopefully specify which operating system is compatible with it, just like off-the-shelf applications do. And you'll find that usually on the outside of the package or, of course, on the manufacturer's website if they're any good. So the second question that you need to ask is, are the applications programmed for a single user or multi-users? You don't want to use a multi-user application that's programmed to work with Windows Server. Yep.
All right, just like, is that, you have to actually get that information off your, whoever you're doing this for. It doesn't sort of just tell you on the packet or something, because aren't some programs you can't use them with multi-users, can you?
No, but the manufacturer will always give you the information, or should always give you the information about what OSs can use what. If it's not on the package, it will definitely be on their website. So a bit of research is involved to know what the application will work with. And the manufacturer, if they're worth their salt, should tell you.
Now did you say that,
yep.
Sorry, that one of those operating systems before, was it Ubuntu, did you say?
No, Ubuntu.
Ubuntu, I love it.
Yes, somebody's having their two centuries in there. Is it cinnamon or sage?
There it goes, so I can hear it.
Oh, welcome to the lecture, Cinnamon.
It's cinnamon, yeah.
Good on you. Okay, so you need to choose apps that work with the right flavour of OS, either a network or a desktop. And, of course, if the computer is going to be connected to a network, you need to recommend the same OS platform that the other computers on the network use. The next question is, are any data files shared with other computers, such as a laptop or a home computer? To ensure compatibility of file formats, recommend the same OS platform that the other data file sharing computers use, and that seems fairly obvious as well. As an example, your customer has a Windows network installed and wants to add more computers to the network. In that case, you need a Windows OS for the new computer. I don't know if that's totally cut and dry, but yes, it's a good rule of thumb to use. If the customer doesn't have any existing computer equipment, of course you could choose anything you like, depending on the customer's needs and the budget, of course. It's also a very important recommendation. It's not something this course goes into a great deal. I think it would make it very interesting, for instance, if they gave you a budget on some of these component choice exercises and say, okay, this customer has this much to spend, find them a system that does these things. That really would be a challenge. So what you need to, in summary, what you need to do is review the budget constraints, learn how the computer will be used, and determine which type of applications will be installed on it. And that is the real basic thing of choosing your operating system. But I did mention hardware before, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Have I confused anyone yet?
No.
Okay. Not yet.
Ah, I haven't confused them yet, Ee. What am I going to do? I've only got so many minutes to go. Goodness me.
No, keep trying. Keep trying, hon.
Oh, okay. Right. Minimum hardware requirements. This is really important. Okay. You need to look at the charts and the related diagrams in this section 5.3. And there's a lot of information in there about minimum processor, hard disk, RAM, and video adapter needs for an OS. Now, you may even be tested on these, so don't learn them off by heart, but be aware of the different requirements, especially for XP, Vista, and Windows 7, and the professional versions of each. Now, these are really, really minimal requirements. Good luck running the OS and all the apps you need on those. That's what I say. I want to double them at least. For instance, it says here that most Windows 7 flavors can run on a minimum of 1 GHz processor. Good luck, especially with all the apps and things that you need. Even a 64-bit, actually, it says that. The only time it differentiates from that is when you're looking at Ultimate from memory. So have a look at that chart in section 5.3. You need to up and ask whether it's cost-effective.
Gosh, I'm running it.
Hmm?
I'm running at 2.53 gigahertz, and I still complain about how slow it is.
Exactly. They're laughably minimal requirements, but they are minimal requirements, and I suppose, and you'll need to learn them for the exams. That's just a little general test alert there. Okay, some upgradable hardware. Can people tell me what parts of the computer hardware might be upgradable?
Your CPU?
Yeah, and?
Memory.
Yeah, and?
Well, you could always get a bigger hard drive.
Yes, exactly, and? John, your turn.
Could upgrade your video card.
Yay! Yep, those are all upgradable parts. Okay, so you need to look at them, not only the minimum requirements of the OS, but the minimum requirements of all the apps you're going to be using as well. You have to meet or exceed, I'd say exceed doubly, the minimal requirements of all the OS and apps that you're going to have on a computer.
Here's Miss Future-proof here.
Oh yeah, very important, because if you don't get the best that you can afford at the time, you're just going to be spending more money down the road a lot more quickly than you otherwise would do. I mean, this computer cost me a lot when I bought it, but it's 6.5 years old now and I haven't had to do a thing to it, so hey, I rest my case. Of course, you have to have hardware-software compatibility as well. Manufacturers of an OS have a hardware compatibility list, or HCL. It's a bit of a test alert, which tells you these. Now, the list might not be comprehensive. Diagram 3 of the section doesn't actually tell you much, so you might like to go onto the Microsoft website and do a search for the HCL of your operating system. And of course, there's the related worksheet. So, about really, in terms of hardware compatibility, look at the hardware compatibility list from the manufacturer, from Microsoft, and exceed the requirements. That's basically that section in a nutshell. And that, my friends, is our first hour almost before I hand over to our guest lecturer, who's going to talk about installing an operating system. Has anyone got any questions or comments? Well, all fall asleep. I'm sure our guest will wake you up in short order. I don't need to introduce her to those of you here today or those of you in Listenland, because by now you now know who she is. She's been a long-time instructor at CAVI and is very, very experienced techie, and has had recent experience installing Windows 7 as well as other OSs. So I'd like to now hand over to Elise Lonsdale to run the second half of this lecture. Thank you very much, Elise.
Thank you, girlfriend. Yes, I'm Elise Lonsdale, friend, mentor, coach, kicker up the ass, as I think Kylie said an hour ago. Okay, to Kylie. No, it's been wonderful working with Kylie. How long did you want me to go for? Was it 40 minutes or 60?
Do 50, and then we can have 10 minutes to discuss worksheets and stuff. And then, yeah.
I think I'll get it done in less than that, but anyway, let's see how we go. All right.
Cool, less is better.
Installing. Hey?
Yeah, less is better than more.
Yep, that's exactly right. All right, now, let's have a quick round robin. Who here has installed an operating system?
No.
I have, unfortunately.
I've sat in when someone else has done it.
You've sat in, yep. Anybody else? Yes, I think you said to me before, welcome, Pat. Yeah, well, I said you could jump in on this lecture and have a listen.
Well, hello, Pat. Good to see you
Pat
here.
Dropped in, yeah. I was talking to Pat before. John, how'd you go? You've installed operating systems, haven't you?
No, I have not.
All right, that's okay. No problemo. Okay, I've been installing the damn thing since DOS. There you go. Can't get out of it. I was given a baptism of fire in Windows 95 when that first came out from Windows 3.1 to 95. I was handed the disk at work and said, here, learn this. You've got to teach it to a whole heap of trainers and instructors in 2 weeks. Great. Oh, and that includes go and figure out how to install it too. Okay, fine. Okay, let's go on with it. Basically, most operating systems run through a similar set of criteria. The first thing you've got to do when you install a software, an operating system, is to set up your hard drive and partition off your hard drive, whether it be having the operating system and the data on one partition or whether you want to have separate partitions for your operating system and for your data. And then that's often referred to as laying out the hard drive. And then from there you go ahead and install into the first partition. If it's Windows, if it's Linux, you can install anywhere because Linux is very kind. Basically Windows likes to be on the first partition.
So to do that partitioning of your hard drive, though, is that done in your BIOS or do you have to do that on another machine first?
Okay, Kim's going to do an exercise with me on another machine, just because we can. The hard drive I installed into my Drupal EPC, I partitioned on another machine and then took that hard drive and put in there. However, most operating systems, including Windows XP, which is what I did put on the Drupal, allows you to do some partitioning in the first part of the setup, and we'll run through that here with you. It's got it all in here in the notes. So all operating systems do allow you, be it Linux or Windows, to install. Before you actually start installing, it will actually ask you how you want to lay out your hard drive. The Windows one's a little bit sort of basic. It really only offers you it sort of simply says, do you want to create a partition, and it offers you a size, and that's what you did. I did that on Windows 7 on Jackie's machine, and on my own I just specified 60 gig, and it didn't even tell you whether it was a primary partition or a logical drive in a second in the extended area or any of that sort of stuff. It just goes ahead and creates them. So for all the non-technically savvy people, that's probably okay. For us technical people, we generally like to have a bit more information than that. So let's begin the installation of an operating system according to the notes. I was going to have a look through some of the worksheets to be quite honest as to what comes first. I couldn't tell you half the time because I just follow the prompts, which is really all you need to do. But basically, mostly...
Yeah, it's an overgrown wizard, really.
Yeah. Okay, I've got here two lots of notes. One's for Vista and the first lot are for XP. You don't have notes here for 7, Kylie?
No, there aren't notes for 7 actually in the notes either. You'll find in your chapter notes there isn't a way of installing 7. Then the labs for that are still awaiting arrival. But for now, it's only XP and Vista. But I'm picking that 7 is even more simple than Vista is in terms
of. If I remember rightly, it's pretty much virtually the same. I've only ever done one Vista installation. I've done a number of 7s now. Anyway, so yeah, you've done a couple, haven't you, Kim? Right.
Just be aware, folks, of the terminology around partitioning. It's all in your notes. What a partition is, what a logical partition, a primary partition, an extended partition. You need to know those things. Windows has a big hissy fit, and if you haven't got the primary partition as C, especially in earlier versions, it really does object very severely.
Oh, yeah, I had one last year that was trying to install itself on drive F. If you ever find a Windows system come up and F is any other drive other than C is your primary drive, or your system drive, just kill it and do it again. Save yourself the hassle. We had one last year that Craig and I did. Yeah, go ahead.
If you don't want to partition your drive, like, and you don't want to put your programs on one, your OS on one part of it and your files on another, do you just consider your whole drive to be a partition?
One partition on the drive, yep. Within a partition goes the file system. This is important because you have you can have one or more partitions on a hard drive, and within each of those partitions are the respective file systems. So, for example, on one dual boot machine I've got here, for example, we have a partition for NTFS, which houses the Windows. Actually, there's four partitions on this hard drive. There's one for NTFS that houses Windows, one for Linux. One with ext4, which is housing Linux, one with another file system that will probably house another operating system, and the fourth one being data. And because everything reads NTFS these days, I've made the data partition NTFS. So yeah, within each partition you have a file system, and on that file system goes your operating system. And the older partition types, you have the primary partition, which is you can have up to four primary partitions, and there's the newer partitioning type, GUI, I think it's called. I'm not really sure. The new one that will allow you not to be restricted by that, but the older one, and that's what most of us are still based on here, is the four primary partitions, and you can have up to four of those. And then you can have an extended area, and you can have a logical drive within the extended area or multiple logical drives within the same extended area. Linux doesn't care where you install it. You can put it anywhere, but with Windows, it does. And we had one that we partitioned up a hard drive on another machine, and I can't remember what we were doing, but Windows decided to see all the partitions, and we said go and install into the first partition, and it tried to call it F. So we went, no, that's no good. The run I did recently, it sorted it out and went into C, which was good, and called it C, and was the first primary partition on the hard drive. Okay, so what do we do? If the drive is not already partitioned, we can do it within the OS. So let's find out what it says here in the notes, because I've only had a quick read. Essentially what you do, let's say we're going to start off with a blank hard drive, no operating system. Turn on the computer, you'll probably see non-system disk, or words to that effect. As Kylie pointed out in one of the recent editions of IT1, that you can check in the BIOS to see if the hard drive is being seen by the system. And then obviously for some of us here, you would need sighted assistance for that. Once you've established the hard drive goes, and yes, I did actually do one just before Christmas for my neighbour Liz, and I started seeing, we cannot install Windows here, we can't find a hard drive. Good-o, whipped off the side and found the SATA connector had fallen out. So, once we see a hard drive, we can get moving. Okay, you'll put in the CD. Okay, let me see. Okay, so what we do is we insert the CD and press any key to boot, unless the BIOS has set that it will boot automatically from the CD first. Some people have set their BIOSes up so that they'll boot from the CD first, which is good.
Where's that key?
To press any key, it's the any key. Yep, that's right, you got it. It's the any key. Okay. Okay, it's going to boot off the CD-ROM and will probably copy a heap of temporary files to the hard drive. Okay, now in Windows XP, it will come up in a text-based screen, a blue background screen with white writing. This is where for visioning people, speech is not available. The equivalent part of this in Windows Vista and 7, I think at this point you probably could, I've never tried it, but you probably could run Narrator from this point, because this point of the installation in Windows Vista and 7 is graphical. However, but on the first part of the notes, we're dealing with XP, which isn't. Okay, you'll have a license agreement. Press F8 to accept the license agreement. Okay, you'll find that there, the next screen after license of the licensing information that you've agreed to it by pressing F8 is a petitioning information screen. As I said to you before, all operating systems will let you petition the hard drive if you've not already got it already done. If you've already got it done, you'll be able to see a list of available petitions and instruct Windows on which petition in which to install itself. Okay, in the notes here, it's talking about press enter for unpetition because there might be an option there to allow you to install Windows into the unpetitioned space, which you can do too if there are petitions there, but if there aren't, well, you're just going to go into the unpetitioned space.
Which can, okay, as you'll find, Julie asked before, can be the whole hard drive.
Which is, yes, can be the whole hard drive, yep. Okay, the notes here talk about you've got a choice of how to format it, either with FAT32 or NTFS. Windows XP only supports FAT32 and NTFS. The later versions of Windows only supports NTFS. However, you may not see, you won't see this on modern hard drives because FAT32 is not available to hard drives larger than 4 gig, I do believe, if I remember my notes properly from when I was a student. So there you go. So you'll find that in some of the exams and worksheets. So I think I'm just harking back to some of my own knowledge as a student. I think there were some questions there somewhere around the 4.0 curriculum and probably still in the 4.1 curriculum, which is this one, asking how big, what can be supported with FAT32. So you're not going to see
we'll
it on these large hard drives.
We'll talk more about that next week. I'll introduce you to both file systems as part of next week's lecture.
Yep. However, having said that, if you want to format up a 500 gig hard drive to FAT32 like I did, use Linux. Don't tell Microsoft. Okay, and I did. I have it out there on my CD player, my DVD player, which has a USB connection and a nice big 500 gig hard drive sitting on it. And because it only reads FAT32, that's how I had to do it. Right. Okay. So you go past. You will, however, see probably quick format or normal format. Normal format is really slower because it verifies each bit that it writes, each sector or whatever. But quick format, if you know the hard drive to be in good shape, you can use that and get the job done a bit quicker. Okay, the system will go into, I have a feeling, just going to read a bit, here we go. Okay, what it doesn't tell you in the notes, and I think is vitally important, this is after the formatting phase, it will do a pre-installation copy and copy some files to the system and go into the graphical phase. This is what's not mentioned in the notes. So after the format phase, it then goes graphical. Once in graphical, you'll be asked for regional and language options. Then, if you've got a sight link, you can use the mouse. Your screen will be in chunky, big, horrible, probably 256 color mode, and you know, like not terribly high resolution graphics, but it's usable. And the regional language options are set from drop down boxes. And you can use your tab, so you can actually tab around these screens. At this particular point of the game, I think, and I will stand corrected, you could probably put in a USB sound card and get Narrator up, but I wouldn't want to rely on that. Okay, the next screen is personalize your software, put name and organization here. Okay, at this point, the product key is also required. We had a bit of a wrestle with this because I was looking at the wrong product key. Information. The Windows XP family of operating systems, that is XP Corporate, XP Professional, and XP Home, are all different ISO images and different builds of Windows, which means you do need to use a corporate license. If you're installing corporate, you need to use a professional license if you're installing a key for a professional version license if you're installing professional, and the same for home. In Windows 7, and I'm not sure where it is, I did read it the other day in Vista. In Windows 7, however, it's what key is entered at this point that tells how the operating system will perform. And much more of the operating system is installed prior to entering the key. And that way you can actually not enter the key and put it into, you know, license it within 28 days type mode if you want to explore the differences. You can actually, it's done so for two reasons. You can activate, you can upgrade, use the upgrade anytime facility in Windows 7 to upgrade, and they would probably give you another key if you go through the wizard. I've not tried it, it's been very tempting. The other reason they do that is because Microsoft only have to ship one ISO or one ISO image or support one version of the operating system. So it's what serial number goes in at that point as to whether, you know, it tells it whether it's going to be you know, 7 Home Premium or 7 Professional or whatever, 7 Multimedia, etc. But with Windows XP, which is what we're doing at the moment, we have to put the appropriate key in. Okay, you'll be asked for the computer name and the administrator's password. Now, the administrator's password is an administrator's account that you'll only have to use if you are fixing up Windows through the recovery console. Yuck. It is an account that you won't be really logging onto, but set the administrator password and keep it safe. You'll also be asked for the computer name, and it is a unique identifier and must have no spaces in it. You'll be asked to confirm the date or time. It will pick that up from the BIOS, but you might want to check it anyway to ensure that it's correct. At this point, I seem to remember it also asking you to select what region you're in. I was that back in the language options. It's sometimes I get mixed up. I've installed so many OSs. I just answer the questions when I see them. I can't do it like this, to be honest. Networking settings now, and I got you here. Networking settings will occur if the setup program has plug and played and found your network adapter. If it hasn't, it will skip this section, as did happen on my EEE PC some time ago, and even on the equivalent screen in my current computer I'm talking to you on now with Windows 7. And those screens will only become available if the network card has been detected. If the operating system is too old for the hardware, which is the case on my EEE PC and this machine, well, not so much too old, but just doesn't know about it, it needs you to install the driver. On the integrated motherboards that I've got, the driver comes with the network driver comes with the motherboard drivers on the Gigabyte setup disk. Okay, so if it has detected your network card, which happens on Firebolt and my older machines, you'll be asked to either select an IP address automatically or manually put in an IP address. I usually put mine in because I'm being an administrator, I do. You'll also be asked for the domain or the work group that you're in. A domain is a very big, large collection of computers. A work group is usually something reserved for the smaller home office, small office environment. And you might be under Windows XP Home. It is, I think it's called Home, or Windows or XP Home or something. Windows XP Professional, it's called Work Group. I changed mine to Lonestar. Okay, then we are up to the installing Windows phase. Wait 25 minutes for setup and reboot. Yes, this can vary depending on the speed of your computer and the speed on which the data has been read from the CD media. Okay, enter display settings. Interesting. Most of the time I'll find on most of the time it will actually pick those up for you, but you may need to confirm it. Enter monitor settings. Again, it will pick this up for you and you shouldn't need to fix this. Actual fact, on the EEE PC,
hopefully
I did have to actually fix
worked.
This. Yeah, actually, I think I remember rightly on the EEE, it didn't quite get it. Actually, remember I did that, 4 weeks ago now, Kylie?
Yes, yeah, you're having to do a bit of fiddling there.
Okay, then we're coming to the Welcome to Microsoft Windows screen. Often some people call it the OBE. That's out-of-box experience. Which is where we're starting to set up our Windows after we've copied all the files in. Help to protect your PC. Well, you'll get asked about turning on Windows updates. It's better if you leave it off and go and do that manually and switch it to, as we often say around the CAVI curriculum, Let's look at the time here. Yeah, I've got plenty of it. Set it so that I can install my updates. Notify me that there are updates and you manually install them, etc. Choose network connection cable DSL. Set it to network for most of these because you really don't want Windows managing your internet connection. Anyone with a Windows box managing a network connection, you really need to come and do discovery and get an integrated services router and just set it to network. Be done with it. Okay, activate. You can do this if the network connection has been established, and some of us like me are game enough to do this on an active network connection and let the machine go straight on the net. You can at this point activate your Windows at this point and basically allow it to phone home and talk to Microsoft. Otherwise, you can elect to skip that step and do it later on. Quick yes to register Windows, similar thing. Fill in the registration form. Who will use this computer, which is where I would set the first user, and assign them administrative privileges. That generally is you. In actual fact, it doesn't even ask you. It says, what's the first user? And it just gives you administrative privileges. So let's say we put in a machine earlier where we had to set the administrator's password. That account's very rarely used, if at all. When you're setting this particular account, this is where you can call it Kylie or Kim or John or Pat or Mario or Kate. Who else have I forgotten here? Okay. Terry. And we can set one to Terry if she's the first user. Sorry, Terry. Thank you. Screen comes up. And then you'll probably find you'll be presented with a desktop. Voila, you've just installed Windows XP. And you'll end up with a horrible gating menu. And then you end up having to sit there and go through and switch. Go into the first things one does at the desktop is goes in and switches off horrible things like, you know, hide file extensions for known file types. It's recommended, particularly for vision impaired people, that we do that. And basically go in and do all that sort of stuff and make the system somewhat usable. Are there any questions?
I just did an installation.
Yes, Pat?
I just did a Windows XP installation today. And one thing that I did notice is I had a sighted person help me, of course, but she could use a lot of... I made her use a keyboard. I kept her mouse away from her. But
sure,
she could use... She did use a lot of alt-ends and to get through a lot of those windows through installation. So it is keyboard usable.
Definitely, it is. Yep, alt-ends and alt-y's for yes and tabbing. And you can still see a little marquee around the active button and that sort of stuff when you can tab. The other thing you may at this point need to do is obviously install sound drivers and network drivers if they've not been picked up, and video display drivers. So that's when, if you've got your motherboard disk, you go for that. Generally early in the piece. Get the hardware profile set first, because once you start putting JAWS on and you put in drivers for the hardware, JAWS may or may not see a difference in the hardware and decide to blow away a license key. So I'm sorry, JAWS, but I would recommend any blind people with as good as NVDA is now, that once the computer is got audio, that you put into NVDA in first. And that is because it's going to cause less interruption to your system. Sorry, JAWS, but that's the way I feel. All right. I used to put JAWS on very quickly after an installation, but not these days. No. All right. Vista installation screens are a bit different. And in the way my memory serves me correctly, I've only ever done one Vista installation. I've done plenty of Windows 7. So let's see how it equates to my memory. Having done the last one on the block. Sorry, I'm not going to answer it. Just give us 5 seconds. Unless there's a problem with Kim or something. Hello, everybody still there? You still there, Kim?
I'm still here.
All right. I thought you might have been calling in because yours comes up as a numbered block too. Vista installation screens. Insert the CD and press any key to boot.
Actually, it's a DVD, and that's one of the first differences because it's a hell of a lot bigger. By the way, this is a clean install that are being performed, and you need to know that a clean install wipes anything. So if you're using a hard drive, an existing hard drive, a clean install will wipe all the information that was previously on that drive. So if you've got things that you want to reuse and you want to do a clean install, back them up somewhere else first. There are parts of your notes which will talk about clean install and upgrade, but we like, in this class, we like clean install as your first and pretty much your only option, right?
Okay, that was my client Ross from Thailand. I'm sorry, Ross, we can't fix your email just yet. All right, okay. Vista installation screens. Sorry, screen installations is... fresh installations is good. You can upgrade. I did it with a couple of Windows from 3.11 to 95. Used to sort of work all right. I've never actually done it since, to be honest, because I'm always scared of the result. Especially if you've damaged your operating system, you know. You really don't want to bring half the bugs and nasties from the former one up to the new one, to be blunt. All right, now, Vista installation screens. Insert, yes, as Kylie said, as I went to grab the phone. Sorry for that mistake. Insert the DVD and press the keys to continue. The Vista boot screen will occur. Okay, the first screen will allow you to set up your time and currency, your language, keyboard method, and you can use a mouse here, and it says here much sooner than you could if you're using XP. So things are a little bit different here. We've got the graphical user interface up right away, and the same occurs for 7. 7 and Vista are the same here, I think. So it allows you to get these language and input, set it to US keyboard for input, etc., unless you're in England. You can then, because I remember doing the partitioning part of it actually with the GUI when I set up my 7 machine. Not so long ago. Hit install now. It goes through a collecting information phase. I don't see the partitioning a bit here. Just read ahead. All right, pretty much. Basically, I think you only see the partitioning information if you don't, if you select custom or advanced. And I don't even know how I got there, to be honest. There was obviously a button there. Now, I'm thinking at this stage, narrator might come up. I'm not sure, assuming the machine can talk. I can't see why it wouldn't, to be honest. All right.
It's the box where you can choose either upgrade or custom advanced, and you really want to hit custom advanced to make your installation, because then you'll get so many more options. If you don't, then your whole hard drive will just be used as a partition.
Yeah, which is pretty dangerous. Okay. At this point, it goes through collection of information phase. It will ask you for the product key, but unlike XP, that is not mandatory at this point. You'll often have a last chance to enter your key, but you can do it afterward. You've had Windows for 28 days and allow it to activate. As I said to you before, it's the product key. It's the product key that allows you that tells Windows how to behave, whether it's going to be professional or home premium, etc. Okay, it says here manually choose your edition of Vista. I don't remember seeing that question in the 7 screens when I went through them. Evidently.
You need to choose a version you purchased.
Yeah, evidently with Vista, it's even a bit nicer under 7 here. Vista, you can still choose. If you have entered a different key, it says here in the notes that you've got 30 days to purchase a different license. So if you've entered in a premium home key and you want to make it professional, you can select another version, but you've got 30 days to try Windows in that other version prior to it probably self-destructing. And the world ending and all sorts of nasty things happening, somebody cutting off your cat's tail, etc. In Windows 7, it's whatever key goes in, so you just have to go for it. And as I said to you before, it's so that Microsoft don't have to ship multiple versions of the media around. That's interesting. Oh, here we go. Here's the custom advanced question here. All right, fair enough. And then it's obviously not done anything at this point. It's installation custom advanced. That's where I would probably get the questions about how to lay out your hard drive from the partitioning point of view.
Now button probably copies all the temp files, I would think, wouldn't it?
If I know what it does, to be blunt. It probably just holds it all in an environment variable somewhere and tells it what to do once it does copy all the files. I don't know. Here we go. Yeah, well, I'd have to probably... where do you want your copy? Probably might do a pre-installation copy, to be honest. I'm not exactly sure. I think it's doing a pre-installation copy. So it just reserves a bit of a hard drive space for that. Because here we come up with your partitioning information at this screen, and it's asking you to format your partition. And you won't be able to format FAT32 here. Later two versions of Windows, Vista and 7 don't support it. Okay, installing Windows. This may actually take up to 50 minutes. Okay, reboot now, and don't press any key to boot from DVD if invited to do so. Just let the system boot from the hard drive. That press any key to boot from DVD will boot it from the DVD. You don't want to do that. You just want to let the machine slip through to the hard drive. you end up with a white screen. A white screen, actually. Okay, yep, a white screen. Is that what they call them there? Okay, installing Windows
just,
again, more of a reboot.
It's just a please wait while Windows does its bit. That's all it's saying, really.
Sure. Set up Windows phase. Now we get all the business of it setting up your desktop and things. Okay, it's asking for the user name and putting in your picture and all that sort of stuff. You want a picture with your account at that point, although you can always change these settings once the system's up and running. You can actually put in a password hint, unlike Windows XP. Computer name and desktop background. Protect Windows and update configuration. That's an interesting thing.
Higher versions of Windows Vista and 7 actually have a default of the arrow, which is that horrible, well, actually very nice looking, apparently, transparent thing. But you get to choose what sort of background you want at that point. And we'll talk about more of desktops and
backgrounds.
Oh,
probably the title bars and things are very transparent. Yep. They are, and it actually looks quite nice. It's actually quite nice. Can be a bit confusing at first, though. Okay, review date and time info and set your time zone is a question probably done, from memory, done from a drop-down dialog box. Again, for Pat, can also be done with keyboard commands. Okay, what is your current location, work, home, and it says here, this will not show if network drivers aren't installed. In other words, you're trying to dumb down whether you're on a network at work or a network at home. Really, it's probably easier in the home environment, just answer home. I shudder to think what Microsoft think the differences are, to be blunt, there at that point, because all it's going to do is probably tell you to get an IP address automatically, etc., etc. So I went in and configured all mine up after it was running. Now, this screen about what is your current location when it's talking in the context of the network will not show if network drivers aren't installed or if it hasn't found your network card. Remember how I said the same thing would occur in Windows XP? It didn't occur on my computer. In actual fact, I skipped this step, of course, and when the system came up, I went and did an IP config and found no TCP/IP stack. So I knew that, yes, there was no, hadn't discovered the network card. So I put the motherboard drivers in and everything came up and went like a mad thing and it was all good. Okay, thank you screen and clicking start will appear. Windows then checks computer performance. Windows Vista or Windows 7 will boot for the first time. Okay, log in with your username and chosen password. Unlike Windows XP, it won't come straight to a desktop. It will ask you to log in. Everyone's gone a little bit more security conscious. You will need to go into your account settings and tell it not to require a password if you want to come straight to a desktop. These days, I think with the way everything goes these days, even the user up the street on her own little computer with no real network other than her Ethernet modem, or her modem that gives a little bit of Ethernet, her cable modem still accepts the fact that they've really got to log on these days, and people are accepting that now. Windows creates an account and a desktop profile based on the information that you've put in there. A welcome screen appears, and you are done. Here endeth the session on installing Windows Vista 7 and before that XP. Any questions?
I have one. I'm not sure if this is relevant, but if you have a branded computer and they have this set up with all the drivers and stuff, I didn't know if you knew if it would talk as well.
Yeah, I really should have tried it on the Vostri. Oh, you can try it tomorrow if you like. We can try it. You'll come up as out of box. The first screen you'll get will be, you won't even get the serial number because it's already in the machine. It already knows your serial number, so you'll just come up at the OBE with who you are, basically, for memory. So we can try and run the Raider if you want.
Oh, no, it works with Vista in terms of that, and 7 probably, but I meant when you're doing what they call a restore or reformat with these driver things. Yeah. These all-in-one installations, I didn't know at what point it would talk, if it was just after in the open box or before.
Oh, well, if you're doing it from I'm now a bit confused. I thought you were asking whether it was going to, if you got a branded machine. This is a bit different. I'm not sure what happens. If you're getting one out of the box for the first time, you'll come up at OBE and you should theoretically be able to run the Raider. If you're just doing a rebuild from scratch, I'm not sure. It's probably going to behave a little bit more like the way it did on a clean install.
Okay.
I have a question for students. What's the place where we go to verify that the hardware is working after you have installed? We mentioned it briefly. It says one place you can go on the computer to look to see if all the hardware drivers are in place.
Device manager.
Yay, Terry's got it, the device manager. Okay, so it says that in your notes. Go to your device manager, have a look to see whether it's got any red and yellow things, and if they are, you need to correct those. And Elise has talked about and making sure that all your correct drivers are installed. Now, Windows Update. How do you get to Windows Update in Windows 7 and Vista, anyone?
Type it into the search string.
Yeah, but where in the system is it found? Under where?
It's in the control panel.
Yeah.
No, I'd go to the start menu and type it. Stuff. I'd just go to the start menu and type.
Yes, it says control panel here, but if you don't need to do that, why bother? It's, Cisco has convoluted ways of doing things, unfortunately. Of course, in Windows XP, it's just under the control panel. It's easy to get to. So, and you've got four different choices in Windows Update. Also in your control panel is user accounts. Should we go through how to make a user account? Just because there's a worksheet that involves doing that in this chapter. I actually made an account for my dear departed pussycat. I don't have it now. I just deleted it afterwards, but it was quite fun to do.
Sorry, Kylie, you want me to talk about how to make a user account?
Yep.
Very simple. You just type user accounts in the search bar of Windows 7. Buggered if I know how you meant to get there anyway. I suppose it's under the control panel. I started using the control panel again.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's in the control panel.
Once I degaged it and made it sort of somewhat memorable of the old Windows XP one with a nice list view. It still has hyperlinks, but at least they're in a list view. Just basically go to user accounts and follow the prompts. It'll ask you whether you want it to be an administrator or whether you want to be a standard user. I can try it now if you like.
Yeah, it could do, but it's basically follow the bouncing ball, as Jackie McBride was also always very fond of saying. It's follow the instructions, like many.
Yeah, there's a dialogue that comes up and it says, yep, and if you tab through it after you go user accounts, there's a guest account that's off, which you can probably deal with. There's a create a new account link. What is a user account link? Is it create a new account? And standard user is the default checked, so I won't go any further than here. I don't want to be creating extra users, but it'll be very, very similar to the way it was in Windows XP. It's not hard to do. You just enter in a username and password. It's best practice to just have lowercase usernames, no spaces. The reason for that is it creates, in the case of 7 and Vista, a directory under C:\users called whatever your name is. It's also a good practice to steer away from capital letters too. Get your strength out of your password, and I think it will give you a password hint as well. From there you can change, add a picture and all that sort of stuff, etc.
Basically there are two levels. You have an administrator if you want to be able to do everything to the computer, and limited, which is actually in XP is very limited. I'm not quite sure how less limited it is in Vista and 7, but it's a much lighter level of usability and access to that system. So if you've got someone you want to use that system, you could probably get away. It was a bit impractical with XP because the limited user account was so limited. It might be better in Vista and 7 that you can give someone a limited user account on your machine. But just be aware that when you're creating a user account for your worksheet, when you log on again as that user, your screen reader will sound like it did when you just installed it, of course, because it won't have any of your particular settings on it. What a user account does is the registry just pulls all the right settings to give that user their own personalised and individual experience.
And that includes custom JAWS scripts that you've written or that you've installed. They will go into the users.
It includes everything.
So JAWS will sound, when you start your screen reader, it'll sound as if it's default. It'll have the shared scripts, of course, from that Freedom Scientific you view under the shared version of it, but anything you've done. Just watch it, folks.
Yeah, it can be a bit disconcerting if you didn't know that and you log on to as this new user after you've created your account. As you offer that little worksheet, it'll come up sounding really slow and horrible and just as if you've just installed it. So just be a bit aware of that. Okay, who can tell me the path? Not type in search, by the way, into the search box. What's the path to Device Manager?
Oh.
It's in the control panel.
Under what?
I can't remember because I just type it in.
It's under system. There's a button. Well, there isn't in XP. There's a button in there, and I think it's probably pretty similar under 7 and Vista. Actually, that one. There are some differences that we'll discuss along the way, and some things are quite different. But I think that's pretty similar. There's a button.
Oh, you want me to try and find it in Control Panel in this version of Windows? Let's have a go. Here we go. Hang on. I'll type in Control Panel first.
I thought it was just Device Manager and
it's the wrong control. Yeah.
I've got it here, and I did go to the search box and type in Control Panel, and then if you hit the letter D in the Control Panel, you go date and time and device manager and whatever else you've got to start with D. And device manager is like a link, so I guess you just enter.
Yeah, there's a system link in the device manager. It's all links, and you go to there is actually one of the links in the system box called device manager.
It says system and security here in the notes, and then system, yeah. So it's got an extra step.
Yeah, well, basically, it's a bit like the properties of My Computer. It gives you what version of Windows is installed, and if you've got a service pack there, like I've got SP one on mine, tells me the work group I'm in, basically.
Is that under 7 you're talking about, Ali?
It is. You've also got an advanced system settings, which probably shows you where the environment, which takes you into things like environment variables. The device manager is also accessible from the advanced dialog box. And once that advanced dialog box is present, it's very, very similar to Windows XP. But most vision impaired people tend to hit the search bar because it's convenient.
Exactly. Well, it's just important to know these paths because of the, you may be testing on it. Yes, Kate.
I was just going to say, I've noticed, like Elise was just saying then, that there's, with quite a few things in 7, that there's a couple of different places that you can access things from, and I'm fairly certain that Device Manager was one of those.
Indeed it is. It's very similar with most of these. There's more than one way to skin a cat. I never used to go around via network settings in the control panel for Windows XP /2000. I used to just right-click on the application key on the My Network Neighbourhood or My Network Places icon or whatever it's called, and go in and get it out of the properties from there because it was a damn sight quicker, you know.
Okay, well, the notes on this all are pretty fulsome, folks, and of course the worksheets are reasonably detailed, and we'll talk about worksheets in a minute. I just want to run through the custom installation options a little bit. Here, have we got time? I think we do, because there are also other ways to install Windows. And because installing Windows like that on every computer in an organisation would take way too much time and cost too much money and just be totally impractical. So there's a tool called SysPrep, SYSPREP, that can be useful for installing on multiple machines. And what you do is you make an image of the OS that's already installed, and then you transfer the image onto the multiple machines. And to do this, you create a master installation on one computer. So you run through the installation like Elise said, and this master can include the operating system, software applications, and configuration settings that will be used by the other computers in the organization. So you set it all up on one machine first, and then you run SysPrep, this application. You create a disk image of the configured computer using a third-party disk cloning program, and there are heaps of those out there. Lots of them are free, but one of the more well-known paid one is Norton's Ghost, which a lot of sighted people actually still use and find quite useful. Yes?
I was going to want to tell you what I used to do. I haven't tried it on Windows 7 yet, but it should work. Cut the thing off with Linux. Be done with it.
Of course, yeah, but unfortunately, this being a Windows course, they're not going to tell you interesting good things like that. Anyway, after you've made the image, you copy it onto a server, and when the destination computer is booted, you get a shortened version of the Windows setup program, and it'll create a new system security identifier, SID, install drivers for hardware, create user accounts, and configure network settings to finish the OS install, hopefully. So that's SysPrep. That's one way of installing Windows onto a multiple computer system. You can install directly over a network too, which is another way of getting your installs quickly onto a business system. Now, it says to install XP this way. You prepare the computer by creating a FAT or FAT32 partition of at least 1.5 gig, and I'll talk more about what the differences between FAT32 and NTFS are next week, because they're really important. You must also make the partition bootable and include a network client. I believe that is a test alert. You can also use a boot disk that contains a network client so the computer can connect to a file server over the network. Then you copy the Windows XP installation files, and that's the i386 folder from the installation disk. That's if you're using a 32-bit XP, which probably most people would be doing if they were using XP. You copy that to the network server and make sure to share the directory so that the clients can connect and use the files. Then you boot the computer, connect to the shared directory, and from the shared directory you run the setup program, which is called winnt.exe. That used to be a test alert. It's not now. It's one that I got wrong, actually, I must admit. I could never remember the name of it. It's winnt, and that used to confuse me. Never mind. We all have our different foibles. The setup program copies all of the installation files from the network share onto the hard drive, and after the installation files have been copied, the install continues much the same way as it was performed from a disk. If you're putting Windows 7 on a network, it says to do the following. You need a FAT or FAT32 partition of at least 5 gigabytes, and I think that's a test alert also, either in Chapter 5 or Windows 7, as I said. A lot of the stuff in Chapter 5 is also pertinent to the Windows 7 exam, so pay big attention to it when you're reading your notes. You must make the partition bootable and include a network client in the same way as you would with XP, and you can also use a boot disk that contains a network client so that the computer can connect to a file server over the network in much the same way. Copy the Windows installation 7 installation media to the network server and share the directory in the same way as you would with XP. Boot the computer and connect to the shared directory in the same way, and from the shared directory run the setup program setup.exe, not winnt, that's the difference, setup.exe, not winnt.exe, located in the sources directory. The setup program copies all the installation files to your hard drive, and after the install files have been copied, it'll continue similar to installing from a disk. So that's just really running through very briefly other ways that Windows can be installed. Now, the one way we didn't cover in this chapter is installing from an answer file, and that is actually an accessible way of installing, and we won't do that until chapter 12, I believe. That's actually quite fun, so you get to know how to accessibly install Windows. Just before we leave off here and talk about worksheets, it talks about a recovery disk, and you can use a recovery disk when there has been a system failure and other recovery options have failed, so it's a last resort system only. And it talks about booting in safe mode or booting in last known good configuration, and we'll talk about what those are next week. An automated system recovery, ASR, setup must be created before a recovery can be performed, and you can use the ASR in backup to create the ASR set. This is all not accessible. As Elise said, don't bother using it. Find a more accessible way to do things if you can by catting, backing up any other way. But really, the recovery part of Windows is not accessible, and it's not nice to use.
It's a mongrel to use, and it really encourages you to put all your data on a separate partition, because if you create your operating system, at least you can actually reinstall it. And even if you've got to go through for a day and put all your applications and junk back, that's better to do that than lose your valuable memory, family portraits and photos and happy snaps of your children, etc.
Yeah, basically read your notes about the system recovery disk. You can make one in Windows 7, which is quite handy to do, I guess, which you can't do in Windows XP very easily. And you can use your own made disk in Windows 7. And to do that, you click the Start, Control Panel, System and Security, and Backup and Restore, and then Create a System Repair Disk is under there. So I guess if you typed System Repair Disk into the search box, you would get the same thing. But anyway, then you insert a blank disk, it would have to be a DVD, into the optical disk drive. I click Create Disk. Test the disk by using it to boot the computer. So it's really, really very easy, at least in theory it is. After the system recovery options screen is displayed, you can highlight the operating system that needs to be restored and click Next. And you've got a nice overgrown wizard there again by the look of things here. And the tools should be available are startup repair, system restore, system image recovery, and Windows memory diagnostic and command prompt. The last way of recovering is that some computers come with a factory recovery partition, and that's the sort of virtual partition on your hard drive, which I believe is a bit of a pain. It's not accessible to the user. It just sits there, not doing a hell of a lot. But it is an image of the bootable partition, and it is created when the computer was built. This partition is called a factory recovery partition and can be used, theoretically again, to restore the computer to its original configuration.
It can be used, and you will probably get back the computer to the point of, it's not actually an image of the partition, of course, because it's usually a small, you know, a few gigs of hard drive. It's the Windows as it is, basically. It will bring back the Windows as it is to what it was the day you first ever turned on your computer.
Now, they're a factory partition. If you've got one, either have a special key combination at startup, or you'll sometimes find it in the BIOS settings, but you'll need to talk to the manufacturer about whether your computer has got one of those or not. And that, my friends, is the end of part one of chapter five. Now, I promised to talk about worksheets, but before I do, are there any more comments or questions? Okay, now that's cool. Just read your notes. Be aware, we glossed over it, but it's fairly straightforward. Be aware of when a clean install should be performed and what it does. We'll talk about upgrades next week, not because we recommend them, but because we don't in this class, but because you have to know about them for the exam. But there are a number of worksheets to do, 12 in all, which are a lot, I'm afraid. There are 20 worksheets. And some are common to both XP and Vista, and some are for XP and some for Vista. Choose a track that you want to go down. If you use Windows 7, choose the Vista option. Unless, of course, you've got an XP box you can work on and you'd rather do that. Download also from the QCAT site under the Labs folder the accessibility tips, because there are some things in Chapter 5 you don't have to do because of accessibility problems. So be aware of those. The performance monitor is one of those, but we will talk about the performance monitor next week, because I might get you to write me a paragraph about what the performance monitor is and does and how it collects information, because even though you can't use it, it's important to know about it for other people's benefit and for all the benefit of testing. So you can actually do it in XP, and if you've got an XP box to use, it can be quite gratifying to be able to do it. I did it on this machine, but again, it's not accessible with screen readers on either Vista or 7. That's a backward step on Microsoft's part. Now, Kim, you asked me about how on earth you're going to do an install in theory. With difficulty, actually. All I do is just go through, because there aren't any questions in that worksheet. There's no questions to answer. So basically, apart from just putting done at every step, make comments as you feel you can make them during the install process about what you understand is happening here and what the different options are and why they are, where they are and what they are. So read your notes, listen to the lecture, do any research if you feel you need to, and just send me the worksheet in with those buttons clicked off and any passing comments and things that you want to report to show me that you understand what's actually happening here. It's really all you can do with the install worksheet. Would you concur with that, E?
Yeah, I'd say so. Yeah, just talk to the worksheet and just simply say, I did this. I mean, so I just went done, because I couldn't be bothered typing anything in mine when I was a student. Or I'd like a dollar for every time I've seen this bloody screen before, etc. That's about the comments I ever put in it. For those of you who haven't had that experience, I guess you can try and convince Kylie that you think you might know what's going to happen if you ever strike this in real life, I guess.
So basically use your imagination.
Pretend
I'm standing behind you and you're showing me what to do, pretty much. Or either that, or just take me along with you on the experience. That's what I guess I tried to do, is I can't be there beside you, so bring me in beside you as much as you possibly can. Yes, Kim?
Oh, well, when I did my install initially, all I did is click next, and it worked, because it was one of those It was one of those branded ones where I just had to either install from the partition or make recovery disks, and I did, and it worked. So that's all I did.
Yeah, it's not much to a Windows install. Like, all you have to do is click next, next, next. I mean, say if you're doing Linux or something, you get asked some really interesting questions, like where do you want the mount point, what file system you want to install it onto, how you want to lay out your partition. You pretty much have to answer all those questions. Much more fun.
What I recommend.
So I guess the point is, by some people, there's really nothing much to tell you, is there?
The most I could say is that my monitor was broken, and I had someone sighted plug in another monitor and help me with the prompts. That's all I can say.
Yeah, what I'd suggest you do, actually, because this can be quite daunting, the amount of work that it's involved in Chapter 5, is do all the little ones first. You don't have to do them in numerical order. You know, there's a whole heap of little ones there that are easy. The run commands one, the user counts, they're all, you know, the little short ones. Get them out of the way first, then they're off your back. I'll mark them and send them back, and you can tackle the bigger ones. And of course, if you need our help, please, please ask. That's what we're here for. Does that answer your question about the install, Kim?
Yep, that's fine.
Does anyone else have any question about worksheets while we're here? Oh, and by the way, don't think you have to do them all in 1 week or even two. It doesn't really matter if you fall behind a bit, because you do get a bit of a chance to catch up. As I said, the volume goes back to some level of sanity in Chapter 6. Chapter 7, it says in the access document that there isn't a lab. There actually is, but I'll tell you what how to do that one. It's actually, I found that quite fun. It's installing an all-in-one printer. And instead of actually following the worksheet, I chose a printer off an all-in-one off the net, and got down its manual and demonstrated how I would install it following the manual. So it's actually reasonably fun. It's only one lab for Chapter 7. And the Chapter 8 labs, it's a fairly light workload. It's new concepts, but the workload is relatively light. So, and of course, after Chapter 8, we'll hit Easter, which will give you another week's break. So really, don't be panicking if you can't get all these worksheets done now, because it'll all work out over the whole period of the course. And I'm not going to put a gun to your head if I don't see worksheets coming in straight away. It's not what we're about. So don't be stressed about that. Just do as much as you can and ask if you need us. And that, ladies and gentlemen, endeth the first part of Chapter 5. I kind of got challenged to do it in two rather than the three that I had kind of planned, and it looks like we're doing it. So it's game on next week, people.
Great work.
We'll probably be there.
I'm going ahead, whether you're there or not. But it's a good session, folks. Thanks so much for coming. It's great to have you all along, to have such dedicated and keen students. So keep up the great work, and yell if you need us.